hours a day, every day, and that person gets, on average, 2 tickets a year. I drive maybe 6 hours each day. How many tickets should I have? This is what I ask. I'm just saying I personally get scared. I get only 2-3 tickets a year, Kathy. I knew this man, a cab driver in New York for 30 years. No license. And this man... Kathy didn't want to hear about the man in New York. I'm just saying, Kathy, in Syria we have a saying. The crazy person talks, the wise person listens. But you're the one talking. Zaytoun had to laugh. She always got the best of him. I'll call you later, she said. Zaytoun headed to the West Bank to get a look at the Tangerine bathroom. He tried to be amused by the fickle nature of clients' tastes. It was part of the job, and if he got exasperated every time someone changed their mind, he'd never survive. The upshot was that it ensured no day was dull. The intensely personal nature of his business, the subjectivity of taste, the variables of light and curtains and carpets, guaranteed that minds would reevaluate and work would have to be redone. Still, the most unusual requests often came from the most normal-seeming people. One customer, a Southern belle in her 60s, had called Zaytoun Painting and had been happy to talk with Kathy with her chatty demeanor and familiar accent. But when the painter showed up to begin work on the exterior of her home, the woman immediately called Kathy. I don't like these men, she said. What's wrong with them? Kathy asked. They're swarthy, she said. I only want white people working on my house. She said it like she was choosing a kind of dressing for her salad. White people, Kathy laughed. Sorry, we're fresh out of those. She convinced the woman that the men who'd been sent, all of them Latino in this case, were skilled professionals who would do an excellent job. The woman assented, but continued to call. He's too short to be a painter, she said about one worker, Hector, who was over 6 feet tall. Realizing that no matter how much she complained, she wouldn't be able to replace these painters with taller Caucasian ones, the Southern belle resigned herself to watching the men, checking on them frequently. Of course, every so often, would-be clients couldn't get past Zaytoun's last name. They'd call for an estimate and ask Kathy, Zaytoun, where's that name come from? Where is he from? And Kathy would say, oh, he's Syrian. Then, after a long pause or a shorter one, they would say, oh, okay, never mind. It was rare. But not rare enough. Kathy sometimes told Zaytoun about such incidents, sometimes not, and never at dinner. Usually he just laughed it off, but occasionally it got under his skin. His frustration with some Americans was like that of a disappointed parent. He was so content in this country, so impressed with and loving of its opportunities. But then why, sometimes, did Americans fall short of their best selves? If you got him started on the subject, it was the end of any pleasant meal. He'd begin with a defense of Muslims in America and expand his thesis from there. Since the attacks in New York, he'd say, every time a crime was committed by a Muslim, that person's faith was mentioned, regardless of its relevance. When a crime's committed by a Christian, do they mention his religion? If a Christian stopped at the airport for trying to bring a gun on a plane, is the Western world notified that a Christian was arrested today and is being questioned? And what about African Americans? When a crime's committed by a black man, it's mentioned in the first breath. An African American man was arrested today. But what about German Americans? Anglo Americans? A white man robs a convenience store and do we hear he's of Scottish descent? In no other instance is the ancestry mentioned. Then Zaytun would quote the Quran. Be one who is staunch in equity, witnesses for God, even against yourselves, or ones who are your parents or nearest of kin, whether rich or poor, for God is closer to both than you are. So follow not your desires that you become unbalanced, and if you distort or turn aside, then truly God is aware of what you do. Kathy was astonished at how well he knew the book, and how quickly he could quote a passage appropriate for any occasion. Still, though, these monologues at dinner? It was good for the kids to have some awareness of such prejudices, but to see Zaytun disappointed, to get him so worked up after a long day, it wasn't worth it. In the end, though, Zaytun could laugh this kind of thing off, but the one thing he couldn't abide was a client raising their voice to Kathy. There had been one client, a young woman married to a doctor. She was thin, pretty, immaculately put together. She hadn't set off any alarm bells when Zaytun had provided an estimate and begun work on painting her stairway and guest bedroom. She told him that she and her husband were expecting house guests, and she wanted the stairway and guest room painted in 5 days' time. Zaytun said the timetable would be tight, but would present no problems on his end. She was thrilled. No other painter had been able to commit to such a deadline. Zaytun sent a crew of three over the next day. The client, seeing the quick and efficient work Zaytun's team was doing, asked him if they could paint her husband's office and her daughter's bedroom, too. He said they could. He sent more painters to the house, and she continued to add rooms and jobs, including retiling and painting a bathroom, and Zaytun's men continued to execute the work quickly. But not quickly enough. On the third day, Kathy phoned Zaytun near tears. The woman had called Kathy 4 times in rapid succession, cursing and carrying on. The house wasn't ready, the client had screamed, and her guests were coming in less than 2 days. Kathy had told her that Zaytun's crew had finished the original work on the guest room in plenty of time, but this wasn't what the client wanted. She wanted everything. All 7 rooms and their myriad tasks done in 5 days. She wanted 3 times the work done in the same amount of time. Kathy had tried to reason with her. She and Zaytun had never promised that he could finish all of the additional work in 5 days. That schedule was irrational. No one, not even Zaytun A Painting Contractor LLC, could complete the work on that timetable. But the client was beyond reason. She barked at Kathy, hanging up, calling again, hanging up. She was loud, condescending, and cruel. Kathy, in tears, reached Zaytun on his cell phone while he was driving to a job on the other side of the city. Even before they hung up, he turned his truck around and was barreling to the client's house as fast as was legal. When he got there, he walked calmly into the house and told his crew they were leaving. In the space of 10 minutes, they packed their paint, ladders, brushes, and tarps, and loaded them onto the bed of Zaytun's truck. As Zaytun was backing out, the client's husband ran out to the truck. "What's wrong?" he asked. "What happened?" Zaytun was so angry, he could barely think of the words in English. It was better, in fact, that he didn't speak. He waited a few seconds to say only that no one talked that way to his wife, that he was leaving the job, that this was over, and good luck. When he arrived at the Tangerine bathroom house, he called Kathy to run through the prices for the materials they'd need. Looking around the orange room, it really was difficult to look at. He noted the client's new tub, a huge claw-footed antique. "It's big, but isn't it beautiful?" Kathy asked.
"Yes, like you," he joked.
"Watch it," she said. "I can lose this weight, but you're never growing that hair back." When they'd met, Kathy had been weight-obsessed and was far too thin. She'd been chubby as a child, at least to some eyes, and in her teens, her weight fluctuated wildly. She binged and dieted, and then cycled through it all again. When she and Zaytoun were married, he insisted that she get beyond the weight issues and eat like a normal person. She did, and now joked that she'd gone too far. "Thank God for the abaya," she told friends. When she didn't want to bother worrying about clothes or how they looked on her, the shoulder-to-floor Islamic dress solved the problem, and tidily. There was a knock on the door. Kathy went to answer it and found Melvin, a Guatemalan painter. He was looking to get paid before the weekend. Zaytoun was relentless in his efforts to pay the workers well and promptly. He always quoted the Prophet Muhammad, "Pay the laborer his wages before his sweat dries." Zaytoun used that as a bedrock and constant guide in the way he and Kathy did business, and the workers took note. Still, Zaytoun preferred to pay on Sundays or Mondays, because when he paid on Fridays, too many of the workers would disappear all weekend. But Kathy's heart was soft. Her resolve to withhold payment, even an hour, weakened in the presence of these workers soaked with sweat, knuckles bleeding, forearms yellow with sawdust. "Don't tell Zaytoun," she said, and wrote him a check. Kathy turned on the TV and flipped through the channels. Every station was covering the storm. Nothing had changed. Katrina was still headed their way, and it was losing no power. And because the hurricane as a whole was traveling so slowly, about 8 miles per hour, the sustained winds were causing, and would continue to cause, catastrophic damage. The coverage was just background noise, though, until Kathy caught the words "family of five." They were talking about the family lost at sea. "Oh no," she thought. "Please." She turned up the sound. They were still missing. The father's name was Ed Larson. He was a construction supervisor. "You're kidding me," she thought. He'd taken the week off to take his family sailing on his yacht, the Sea Note. They'd been at Marathon and were sailing back to Cape Coral when they'd lost radio contact. His wife and three kids were with him. They were on their way back to shore for a family reunion. The extended family had gathered, only to realize that the Larsons were missing. The celebration turned into a vigil of worry and prayer. Kathy couldn't stand it. She called her husband. "We have to go."
"Wait, wait," he said. "Let's wait and see."
"Please," she said.
"Really," he said. "You can go."
Kathy had taken the kids north a handful of times when storms had gotten close, but she was hoping she wouldn't have to make the trip this time. She had work to do over the weekend, and the kids had plans, and she always came back from those trips more exhausted than when she'd left. Almost without exception, whether it was fleeing a storm or for a weekend vacation, Kathy and the kids had to go without Zaytoun. Her husband had trouble leaving the business, had trouble relaxing for days on end, and after years of this vacationless life, Kathy had threatened to pack the kids and just leave for Florida some Friday after school. At first, Zaytoun hadn't believed her. Would she really pack up and leave with or without him? She would, and she did. One Friday afternoon, Zaytoun was checking on a nearby job and decided to stop at home. He wanted to see the kids, change his shirt, pick up some paperwork. But when he pulled into the driveway, there was Kathy, loading up the minivan, the two youngest already buckled inside.
"Where are you going?" he asked.
"I told you I'd go with or without you, and we're going." They were going to Destin, Florida, a beach town on the Gulf about 4 hours away, with long white beaches and clear water.
"Come with us, Daddy," Nadima pleaded.
She'd just come out of the house with their snorkeling gear. Zaytoun was too stunned to react. He had 100 things on his mind, and a pipe at one of the rental properties had just burst. How could he go? Nadima got in the front seat and put on her seatbelt. Bye-bye, Kathy said, backing out. See you Sunday. And they were gone, the girls waving as they left. He didn't go that Friday, but after that, he no longer doubted Kathy's resolve. He knew she was serious, that in the future he'd be consulted on vacation plans, but that trips to Florida or beyond could and would happen with or without him. So over the years, there were other trips to Destin, and he even made it on a few of them. But always his decision was made at the last minute. One time, Kathy was late in getting started, and he was so late in deciding that he couldn't even pack. She was in the driveway backing out when he pulled in. "Now or never," she said, barely stopping the car. And so he jumped in the car. The girls giggled to see their dad in the back seat, still in his work clothes, dirty and sweating, as much from the stress of the decision as from the day's work. Zaytoun had to buy beach clothes when they got to Florida. Kathy was proud that she'd gotten him to Destin once a year. Zaytoun didn't mind going too much, because given how close it was, he knew he could come back at any time, and more than once, he'd cut a vacation short because of some problem at one of the work sites. By 2002, though, Kathy wanted something that really felt like a vacation, and she knew she had to do something drastic. In all their time together, 8 years at that point, he'd never taken more than 2 days off in a row. She knew that she had no choice but to kidnap him. She started by planning a weekend in Destin. She chose a weekend when she knew things would be calm at work. It was just after Christmas, and there was rarely much work till well after New Year's. As usual, Zaytoun wouldn't commit till the last minute, so she took the precaution of actually packing a bag for him and hiding it in the back of the minivan. Because she'd made sure the weekend was quiet, he came along, as always, at the last minute. Kathy told him she'd drive, and because he was exhausted, he agreed. She made sure the kids were quiet. They were in on the plan, and he soon fell asleep, drooling on his seatbelt. While he slept, Kathy drove right on through Destin and onward down the Ponch of Florida. Each time he woke up, she'd say, "Almost there, go back to sleep." And thankfully he would. He was so tired. And it wasn't until an hour north of Miami that he realized they weren't going to Destin. Kathy had driven straight down to Miami, 17 hours. She checked on the computer for the warmest place in the country that week, and Miami was it. Being that far away was the only way to ensure he would take a real vacation, a full week's worth of rest. Every time she thought back on the gambit and how well it had worked, Kathy smiled to herself. A marriage was a system like any other, and she knew how to work it. At about 2:30, Ahmed called Zaytoun again. He was still tracking the storm from his computer in Spain. "Doesn't look good for you," he said. Zaytoun promised he would keep watch on it. "Imagine the storm surge," Ahmed said. Zaytoun told him he was paying close attention. "Why not leave, just to be safe?" Ahmed said. Kathy decided to go to the grocery store before picking up the girls from school. You could never tell when people would make a run on the basics before a storm arrived, and she wanted to avoid the crush. She went to the mirror to adjust her hijab, brushed her teeth, and left the house. Not that she thought about it much, but any trip to the grocery store or the mall presented the possibility that she would encounter some kind of ugliness. The frequency of incidents seemed tied, to some extent, to current events, to the general media profile of Muslims that week or month. Certainly after 9/11 it was more fraught than before, and then it had calmed for a few years. But in 2004, a local incident had stoked the fire again. At West Jefferson High School, a 10th grader of Iraqi descent had been repeatedly harassed by her history teacher. He'd called Iraq a third-world country, had worried that the student would bomb us if she ever returned to Iraq. In February of that year, while passing out tests, the teacher had pulled back the girl's hijab and said, "I hope God punishes you." "No, I'm sorry, I hope Allah punishes you." The incident was widely reported. The student filed a lawsuit against him, and his termination was recommended by the Jefferson Parish School District Superintendent. The school board overruled. He was given a few weeks' suspension and returned to the classroom. After the decision, there'd been an uptick in minor harassment of Muslims in the area, and Kathy was aware of the invitation she was providing in going out in her hijab. There was a new practice in vogue at the time, favored by adolescent boys or those who thought like them. Sneak up behind a woman wearing a headscarf, grab it, and run. One day it happened to Kathy. She was shopping with Asma, a friend who happened to be Muslim but who wore no hijab. Asma was originally from Algeria and had been living in the U.S. for 20 years. She was usually taken for Spanish. Kathy and Asma were leaving the mall, and outside, Kathy was trying to remember where she'd parked her car. She and Asma were on the sidewalk, Kathy squinting at the row of gleaming cars, when Asma gave her a funny look. "Kathy, there's a girl behind you." A girl of about 15 was crouched behind Kathy, her arm raised, about to yank the hijab off Kathy's head. Kathy cocked her head. "You got a problem?" she barked. The girl cowered and slunk away, joining a group of boys and girls her age, all of whom had been watching. Once back with her friends, the girl directed some choice words Kathy's way. Her friends laughed and echoed her, cursing at Kathy in half a dozen different ways. They couldn't have expected Kathy to return the favor. They assumed, no doubt, that a Muslim woman, presumably submissive and shy with her English, would allow her hijab to be ripped from her head without retaliation. But Kathy let loose a fusillade of pungent suggestions, leaving them dumbfounded and momentarily speechless. On the drive home, even Kathy was shocked by what she'd said. She'd been brought up around plenty of cursing, and knew every word and provocative construction. But since she'd become a mother, since she'd converted, she hadn't sworn more than once or twice. But those kids needed to learn something, and so she'd obliged. In the weeks after the attacks on the Twin Towers, Kathy saw very few Muslim women in public. She was certain they were hiding, leaving home only when necessary. In late September, she was in Walgreens when she finally saw a woman in a hijab. She ran to her. "Salaam alaikum," she said, taking the woman's hands. The woman, a doctor studying at Tulane, had been feeling the same way, like an exile in her own country, and they laughed at how delirious they were to see each other. On this day in August, the grocery store trip went off without confrontation, and she picked up her girls. "You hear about the storm?" Nadima asked. "It's coming toward us," Safiya added from the back seat. "Are we going to leave?" Nadima asked. Kathy knew that her kids wanted to. They could go to one of their cousins' homes in Mississippi or Baton Rouge, and it would be a vacation, a two-day sleepover. Maybe school would be canceled on Monday as the city cleaned up. This was surely what they were thinking and hoping. Kathy knew the workings of her children's minds. When they got home, it was 5 o'clock, and Katrina was all over the news. The family watched footage of enormous waves, uprooted trees, whole towns washed gray with torrential rain. The National Hurricane Center was suggesting that Katrina would soon become a Category 3. Governor Blanco, held a press conference to declare a state of emergency for Louisiana. Governor Barber did the same for Mississippi. Kathy was rattled. Sitting on the arm of the couch, she was so distracted that soon it was 6 o'clock and she hadn't started dinner. She called Zaytoun. "Can you get Popeyes on your way home?" she asked. At home, Nadima arranged the tablecloth and placemats. Sophia and Aisha set out the silverware and glasses. Kathy threw together a salad and poured milk for the kids and juice for herself and Zaytoun. Zaytoun arrived with the chicken, showered, and joined the family for dinner. "Finish, finish," he said to his daughters, who were picking at their food, leaving huge swaths of it uneaten. He'd gotten used to it after all these years, but still, there were times when the waste got to him. The disposability of just about everything. Growing up in Syria, he'd often heard the expression, "If your hand doesn't work for it, your heart doesn't feel sorry for it." But in the U.S., it wasn't just the prosperity, because New Orleans was not uniformly prosperous, to be sure. There was a sense that everything could be replaced, and on a whim. In his children, he was trying to instill a sense of the value of work, the value of whatever came into their house. But he knew that much would be lost in the context, the waste and excess of the culture at large. He'd been brought up to know that what God hates as much as anything is waste. It was, he'd been told, one of the three things God most hated. Murder, divorce, and waste. It destroyed a society. After dinner, the girls asked if they could watch Pride and Prejudice again. It was Friday night, so Zaytoun had no school-related reasons to block the movie. Still, it didn't mean he had to sit and watch it again. He'd liked the movie fine the first time, but the need to watch it a dozen times in as many days was beyond him. In the past week, he and Zachary had retired to other rooms to do something, anything else. Kathy, though, was right there with the girls each time, and this time all of them draped over each other on the couch, misting up at the same parts they always did. Zaytoun shook his head and went into the kitchen to fix a cabinet door that had gotten loose. All evening, they paused the movie to watch the news reports about the storm's intensity and direction. Still moving slowly, the hurricane was heading up the coast with winds over 100 miles per hour. The longer it lingered over any region, the more destruction it would bring. All the news was terrible. And when Kathy saw the picture of the family of five, she was ready to turn it off. She was sure they were gone, and she would obsess over this family for weeks, thinking about all their relatives gathered for the reunion, now forced to mourn the loss of so many at once. But then Kathy realized that the family was not lost. She turned up the volume. They'd been rescued. They'd docked their boat on a mangrove island near 10,000 islands, and had ridden out the storm in the cabin of the yacht, praying and taking turns climbing up to look for help in the skies. Just hours earlier, the Coast Guard had spotted their boat and lifted them all to safety. The family of five had been saved. Later, after kissing Zachary goodnight, Kathy lay down in Nadima's bed, and the girls arranged themselves around her, a mess of overlapping limbs and pillows. "Who wants to start?" Kathy asked. Sophia began a story about Pokemon. The stories, which the girls told collaboratively, were often about Pokemon. After Aisha introduced the protagonist, Sophia provided the setting and central conflict, and Nadima took it from there. They continued, taking turns advancing the plot, until Aisha was asleep, and Nadima and Sophia were drifting off. Kathy looked up to find Zaytoun in the doorway, leaning against the frame, watching them all. He did this often, just watching, taking it all in. The scene was almost too much, too beautiful. It was enough to burst a man's heart wide open. Saturday, August 27th. Zaytoun and Kathy woke late, after 8. When they turned on the TV, they saw Michael Brown, director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, telling all residents of New Orleans to leave as soon as they could, to head inland with all possible haste. The National Hurricane Center had issued a watch for central Louisiana and warned that the hurricane could become a Category 5 by the time it made landfall. Category 5 hurricanes had only struck the United States mainland 3 times before, and never New Orleans. "Honey," Kathy said, "I think we should go."
"You go," Zaytoun said. "I'll stay."
"How can you stay?" she asked. But she knew the answer. Their business wasn't a simple one, where you could lock an office door and leave. Leaving the city meant leaving all their properties, leaving their tenants' homes, and this they couldn't do unless absolutely necessary. They had job sites all over the city, and any number of things could happen in their absence. They'd be liable for damage if their equipment caused harm to clients' property. It was yet another hazard of the company they'd built. Kathy was leaning strongly toward fleeing, and watching the news throughout the day, it seemed that there were so many new indicators that this storm was unique that she didn't feel she could even contemplate staying in the city. They'd already closed down most operations at Louis Armstrong International Airport. The Louisiana National Guard had called 4,000 troops into service. Mid-morning, it was at least 95 degrees, the air leaden with humidity. Zaytoun was in the backyard, running around with the kids and Mickey, the dog. Kathy opened the back door. "You're really staying?" Kathy asked him. Somehow she thought that he might be wavering. She was wrong. "What are you worried about?" he said. She wasn't worried, in fact. She didn't fear for her husband's safety, really, but she did have the feeling that life in the city would be very trying during and after the storm. The electricity would go. The roads would be covered with debris, impassable for days. Why would he want to struggle through all that?
"I have to watch the house," he said. "The other houses. One small hole in the roof. If I fix it, no damage. If not, the whole house is wrecked."
By the early afternoon, Mayor Nagin and Governor Blanco had called for a voluntary evacuation of the city. Nagin told residents that the Superdome would be open as a shelter of last resort. Kathy shuddered at the thought. The year before, with Hurricane Ivan, that plan had been a miserable failure. The Superdome had been ill-supplied and overcrowded then, and in 98, with Hurricane George. She couldn't believe the place was being used again. Maybe they'd learned from the last time and better provisioned the stadium. Anything was possible, but she was doubtful. Kathy planned to leave as soon as the contraflow took effect, supposedly around 4 o'clock. The contraflow would allow all lanes of every highway to flow outward from the city. By then, Kathy would have the Odyssey packed and ready in the driveway. But where would she be going? She knew well that every hotel within 200 miles would be booked already, so it was a matter of deciding which family member she'd impose on. She'd thought first of her sister Anne, who lived in Poplarville, Mississippi. But when she called, Anne was considering leaving too. Her home was technically within the area that would be affected by the high winds, and it was surrounded by old trees. Given the likelihood that one of them might fall through her roof, Anne wasn't sure she should stay there herself, let alone with Kathy and her kids. The next option was the family headquarters in Baton Rouge. Owned by her brother Andy, it was a 3-bedroom ranch in a subdivision outside the city. Andy traveled frequently and was currently in Hong Kong, working on a construction project. While he'd been gone, two of Kathy's sisters, Patty and Mary Ann, had moved in. Kathy knew they'd allow her family to stay, but it would be cramped. The house wasn't so big to begin with, and Patty had 4 kids of her own. With Kathy's family there, all told, there would be 8 kids and 3 sisters living together in a house that would likely lose electricity in the high winds. Still, it had been some time since the families had gotten together. This might bring them closer. They could all eat out, maybe go shopping in Baton Rouge. Kathy knew her kids would endorse the plan. Patty's kids were older, but they got along well with the Zaytoons, and anyway, 8 kids always found something to do together. It would be cramped and loud, but Kathy found herself looking forward to it. Throughout the afternoon, Kathy tried to convince her husband to come with them. When had officials suggested an all-city evacuation before? She asked. Wasn't that reason enough to go? Zaytoon agreed that it was unusual, but he'd never evacuated before, and he saw no need to do so now. Their home was elevated 3 feet above the ground, and rose 2 stories on top of that, so there would be no danger of getting stuck in an attic or on a roof, even if the worst happened. Zaytoon could always retreat to the 2nd floor, and they lived nowhere near any levees, so they wouldn't get any of the flash flooding that might hit some of the other neighborhoods. It was East New Orleans, or the Lower Ninth, with its 1-story houses so close to the levees that were in the gravest danger. And he certainly couldn't leave before he secured all his job sites. No one else would do it, and he wouldn't ask anyone else to do it. He'd already told his workers and his foremen to leave, to be with their families, to get a head start on the traffic. He planned to go to every one of the 9 job sites to gather or tie down his equipment. He'd seen what happened when a contractor failed to do this. Ladders careening through windows and walls, tools damaging furniture, paint all over the lawn and driveway. "I better go," he said. He set out, visiting the work sites, tying down ladders, packing up tools, brushes, loose tiles, sheetrock. He was through about half the sites when he headed home to say goodbye to Kathy and the kids. Kathy was loading up a few small bags in the back of the Odyssey. She'd packed enough clothes, toiletries, and food for 2 days. They'd return on Monday night, she figured, after the storm had come and gone. Kathy had the minivan's radio on and heard Mayor Nagin repeat his instructions for residents to leave the city, but she noted that he had stopped short of a mandatory evacuation. This would embolden her husband, she was certain. She switched to another station, where they were issuing a warning that anyone who planned to ride out the storm in New Orleans should be prepared for a flood. Levee breaches could happen, they said. Storm surges might cause flooding. 10 or 15 feet of water would be a possibility. Any diehard staying home should have an axe in case they needed a chop through their attic to reach the roof. Zaytoon pulled up and parked the van on the street in front of the house. Kathy watched him approach. She never doubted his ability to care for himself in any situation, but now her heart was jumping. She was leaving him to fend for himself, leaving him to chop holes in the attic with an axe. It was insane. He and Kathy stood in the driveway, as they had many other times when she and the family were leaving and he was staying. "Better hurry," Zaytoon said. "A lot of people leaving at once." Kathy looked at him. Her eyes, much to her own frustration, teared up. Zaytoon held her hands. "Come on, come on," he said. "Nothing's gonna happen. People are making a big deal for no reason." "Bye, Daddy," Aisha sang from the back seat. The kids waved. They always waved. All of his children, as he stood on the driveway. None of this was new. 12 times they'd lived this moment, as Kathy and his children drove off in search of sanctuary or rest, leaving Zaytoon to watch over his house and the houses of his neighbors and clients all over the city. He had keys to dozens of other houses. Everyone trusted him with their homes and everything in them. "See you Monday," he said. Kathy drove away, knowing they were all mad. Living in a city like this was madness. Fleeing it was madness. Leaving her husband alone in a home in the path of a hurricane was madness. She waved. Her children waved. And Zaytoun stood in the driveway, waving until his family was gone. Zaytoun set out to finish securing the rest of his job sites. The air was breezy, the low sky smudged brown and gray. The city was chaotic, thousands of cars on the road. Traffic was worse than he expected. Brake lights and honking, cars running red lights. He took streets that no one fleeing would use. Downtown, hundreds of people were walking to the Superdome, carrying coolers, blankets, suitcases. Zaytoun was surprised. Previous experiments using the stadium as shelter had failed. As a builder, he worried about the integrity of the stadium's roof. Could it really withstand high winds, torrential rain? You couldn't pay him enough to hide there from the storm. And anyway, in the past, it had been little more than a few hours of squealing winds, some downed trees, a foot or two of water, some minor damage to fix once the winds had passed. He already felt good. New Orleans would soon be largely vacated, and being in the empty city always felt good, at least for a day or two. He continued to make his rounds, secured the last few sites, and arrived home just before 6. Kathy called at 6:30. She was stuck in traffic a few miles outside the city. Worse, between her own confusion and the unprecedented volume of cars, she'd gone the wrong way. Instead of taking the I-10 west, directly to Baton Rouge, she was on the I-10 heading east, with no way to correct her error. She'd have to cross Lake Pontchartrain and swing all the way back through Slidell and across the state. It was going to add hours. She was harried and exhausted, and the trip had barely begun. Zaytoun was sitting at home, his feet up on the table, watching TV. He made a point of telling her so. "Told you so," he said. Kathy and the kids were expected at her brother's house for dinner, but at 7 o'clock she'd traveled less than 20 miles. Just short of Slidell, she pulled into a Burger King drive-thru. She and the kids ordered cheeseburgers and fries and got back onto the road. A little while later, a foul odor overtook the Odyssey. "What is that?" Kathy asked her kids. They giggled. The smell was fecal, putrid. "What is that?" she asked again. This time the girls couldn't breathe, they were laughing so hard. Zachary shook his head. "It's Mickey," one of the girls managed, before collapsing again into hysterics. The girls had been sneaking the dog pieces of their cheeseburgers, and the cheese was clogging her pipes. She'd been farting for miles. "That is awful," Kathy wailed. The kids giggled more. Mickey continued to suffer. She was hiding under the seat. They passed Slidell and soon met up with I-190, a smaller road Kathy figured would have less traffic. But it was just as bad, an endless stream of brake lights. 10,000 cars, 20,000 lights, she guessed, extending all the way to Baton Rouge or beyond. She'd become part of the exodus without entirely registering the enormity and strangeness of it. 100,000 people on the road, all going north and east, fleeing winds and water. Kathy could only think of beds. Where would all these people sleep? 100,000 beds. Every time she passed a driveway, she looked at the home longingly. She was so tired, and not even halfway there. She thought again of her husband. The images she'd seen on the news were absurd, really. The storm looked like a white circular saw heading directly for New Orleans. On those satellite images, the city looked so small compared to the hurricane, such a tiny thing about to be cut to pieces by that gigantic spinning blade. And her husband was just a man, alone, in a wooden house. Zaytoun called again at 8 o'clock. Kathy and the kids had been on the road for 3 hours and had only gotten as far as Covington, about 50 miles. Meanwhile, He was watching television, puttering around the house, enjoying the cool night.
"You should have stayed," he said. "It's so nice here."
"We'll see, smart guy," she said. Though she was exhausted and was being driven near crazy by her flatulent dog, Kathy was looking forward to a few days in Baton Rouge. At certain moments, at least, she was looking forward to it. Her family was not easy to deal with, this was certain, and any visit could take a wrong turn quickly and irreparably. "It's complicated," she would tell people. With 8 siblings, it had been turbulent growing up, and when she converted to Islam, the battles and misunderstandings multiplied. It often started with her hijab. She'd come in, drop her bags, and the suggestion would come, "Now you can take that thing off." She'd been a Muslim for 15 years, and they still said this to her, as if the scarf was something worn under duress, only in the company of Zaytun, a disguise she could shed when he wasn't around, as if only in the Delphine household could she finally be herself, let loose. This was actually the command her mother had given the last time Kathy had visited. "Take that thing off your head," she'd said. "Go out and have a good time." There were times, however, when her mother's loyalty to Kathy trumped her issues with Islam. Years earlier, Kathy and her mother had gone to the DMV together to have Kathy's license renewed. Kathy was wearing her hijab and had already received a healthy number of suspicious looks from DMV customers and staff by the time she sat down to have her picture taken. The employee behind the camera didn't disguise her contempt. "Take that thing off," the woman said. Kathy knew that it was her right to wear the scarf for the photo, but she didn't want to make an issue of it. "Do you have a brush?" Kathy asked. She tried to make a joke of it. "I don't want to have my hair all matted for the photo." Kathy was smiling, but the woman only stared, unblinking. "Really?" Kathy continued. "I'm okay with taking it off, but only if you have a brush." That's when her mother jumped to the rescue, in her way. "She can wear it," her mother yelled. "She can if she wants to." Now it was a scene. Everyone in the DMV was watching. Kathy tried to defuse the situation. "Mama, it's okay," she said. "Really, it's okay. Mama, do you have a brush?" Her mother barely registered Kathy's question. She was focused on the woman behind the camera. "You can't make her take it off. It's her constitutional right." Finally, the DMV woman disappeared into the back of the office. She returned, with permission from a superior, to take the photo with Kathy wearing her scarf. As the flash went off, Kathy tried to smile. Growing up in Baton Rouge, it was a crowded house, full of clamor and extremes. 9 kids shared a 1-story, 1,400-square-foot home, sleeping 3 to a room and squabbling over 1 bathroom. They were content, though, or as content as could be expected, and the neighborhood was tidy, working class, full of families. Kathy's house backed up against Sherwood Middle School, a big multi-ethnic campus where Kathy felt overwhelmed. She was one of a handful of white students, and she was picked on, pushed around, gawked at. She grew to be quick to fight, quick to argue. She must have run away from home a dozen times, maybe more. And almost every time she did, from age 6 or so on, she ran to her friend Yuko's house. It was just a few blocks away, on the other side of the high school. And given that she and Yuko were among the few non-African-American kids in the neighborhood, they'd bonded as outsiders. Yuko and her mother Kamiko were alone in their house. Kamiko's husband had been killed by a drunk driver when Yuko was small. Even though Yuko was 3 years older, she and Kathy grew inseparable, and Kamiko was so welcoming and dedicated to Kathy's well-being that Kathy came to call her mom. Kathy was never sure why Kamiko took her in, but she was careful not to question it. Yuko joked that her mom just wanted to get close enough to Kathy to bathe her. As a kid, Kathy didn't like baths much, and they weren't a great priority in her house, so every time she was at Yuko's, Kamiko filled the tub. "She looks greasy," Kamiko would joke to Yuko, but she loved to make Kathy clean, and Kathy looked forward to it, Kamiko's hands washing her hair, her long fingernails tickling her neck, the warmth of a fresh, heavy towel around her shoulders. After high school, Kathy and Yuko grew closer. Kathy moved into an apartment off Airline Highway in Baton Rouge, and they began working together at Dunkin' Donuts. The independence meant everything to Kathy. Even in her small apartment, off a six-lane interstate, there was a sense of order and quiet to her life that she had never known. A pair of Malaysian sisters used to come into the shop, and Yuko began talking to them, questioning them. "What does that scarf mean? What do you see in Islam? Are you allowed to drive?" The sisters were open, low-key, never proselytizing. Kathy had no real inkling that they'd made a great impression on Yuko, but Yuko was captivated. She began reading about Islam, investigating the Quran. Soon the Malaysian sisters brought Yuko pamphlets and books, and Yuko delved deeper. When she caught on to how serious Yuko was about it, it drove Kathy to distraction. They'd both been brought up Christian, had gone to a rigorous Christian elementary school. It was baffling to see her friend dabbling in this exotic faith. Yuko had been as devout a Christian as walked the earth, and Kamiko was even more so. "What would your mom think?" she asked.
"Just keep an open mind," Yuko said. "Please."
A few years passed, and Kathy, through a series of missteps and heartbreaks, was divorced and living alone with Zachary, who was less than a year old. She was renting the same apartment off Airline Highway and working two jobs. In the mornings, she was a checkout clerk at K&B, a chain drugstore on the highway. One day, the manager of Webster Clothes, a menswear store across the road, had come into the drugstore and, admiring Kathy's ebullient personality, asked her if she'd be willing to quit K&B, or if not, take a second job at Webster. Kathy needed the money, so she said yes to the second job. After finishing in the early afternoon at K&B, she'd walk across the highway to Webster and work there until closing. Soon she was working 50 hours a week and making enough to cover health insurance for herself and Zachary. But her life was a struggle, and she was looking for some order and answers. Yuko, by contrast, seemed peaceful and confident. She'd always been centered, so much so that Kathy had been envious, but now Yuko really seemed to have things figured out. Kathy began borrowing books about Islam. She was just curious, having no particular intention to leave the Christian faith. At first, she was simply intrigued by the basic things she didn't know and the many things she'd wrongly presumed. She had no idea, for instance, that the Quran was filled with the same people as the Bible: Moses, Mary, Abraham, Pharaoh, even Jesus. She hadn't known that Muslims consider the Quran the fourth book of God to his messengers, after the Old Testament, referred to as the Torah, or the Law, the Psalms, the Zabur, and the New Testament, Injil. The fact that Islam acknowledged these books was revelatory for her. The fact that the Quran repeatedly reaches out to the other, related faiths, knocked her flat. "We have believed in God, and what has been sent forth to us, and what was sent forth to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the tribes, and what was given the prophets from their Lord, we separate and divide not between any one of them, and we are the ones who submit to him." She was frustrated that she hadn't known any of this, that she'd been blind to the faith of a billion or so people. How could she not know these things? And Muhammad, She'd been so misinformed about him. She thought he was the actual God of Islam, the one whom Muslims worshipped, but he was simply the messenger who related the word of God. An illiterate man, Muhammad was visited by the angel Gabriel, Jibril in Arabic, who related to him the words of God. Muhammad became the conduit for these messages, and the Quran, then, was simply the word of God in written form. Quran meant recitation. There were so many basic things that defied her presumptions. She'd assumed that Muslims were a monolithic group, and that all Muslims were made of the same devout and unbending stock. But she learned that there were Shiite and Sunni interpretations of the Quran, and with any mosque there were the same variations in faith and commitment as there were in any church. There were Muslims who treated their faith lightly, and those who knew every word of the Quran and its companion guide to behavior, the Hadith. There were Muslims who knew almost nothing about their religion, who worshipped a few times a year, and those who obeyed the strictest interpretation of their faith. There were Muslim women who wore t-shirts and jeans, and Muslim women who covered themselves head to toe. There were Muslim men who modeled their lives on the life of the Prophet, and those who strayed and fell short. There were passive Muslims, uncertain Muslims, borderline agnostic Muslims, devout Muslims, and Muslims who twisted the words of the Quran to suit their temporary desires and agendas. It was all very familiar, intrinsic to any faith. At the time, Kathy was attending a large evangelical church not far from her jobs. Though not always full, it could seat about 1,000 parishioners. She felt a need to connect with her faith. She needed all the strength she could find. But there were things about this church that bothered her. She was accustomed to the kind of fiery preaching that the church offered, the extremes of showmanship and drama. But one day, she thought, they crossed a line. They'd just passed the collection plates, and after they'd gathered and counted the funds donated, the preacher, a short man with a rosy face and a mustache, seemed disappointed. His expression was pained. He couldn't hold it in. He chastised the congregation, calmly at first, and then with increasing annoyance. Did they not love this church? Did they not appreciate the connection this church created with their Lord Jesus Christ? He went on and on, shaming the congregants for their miserly ways. The lecture lasted 20 minutes. Kathy was aghast. She'd never seen the collection counted during a Sunday service, and to ask for more. The congregants weren't wealthy people, she knew. This was a working-class church, a middle-class church. They gave what they could. She left that day, shaken and confused by what she'd seen. At home, after putting Zachary to bed, she turned again to the materials Yuko had given her. She flipped through the Quran. Kathy wasn't sure that Islam was the way, but she knew that Yuko had never misled her before, that Yuko was the most grounded and sensible person she knew, and if Islam was working for her, why wouldn't it work for Kathy? Yuko was her sister, her mentor. Kathy struggled with the question of faith all week. She lived with the questions in the morning, at night, all day through work. She'd just started her shift at Webster one day when a familiar man walked in. Kathy recognized him immediately as one of the preachers at the church. She came over to help him with a new sport coat. "You know," he said, "you should come to our church. It's not far from here." She laughed. "I know your church. I'm there all the time, every Sunday." The man was surprised. He hadn't seen her before. "Oh, I sit in the back," she said. He smiled and told her that next time he'd look for her. He made it his business to make sure everyone felt welcome. "You know," Kathy said to him, "this must be a sign from God, seeing you here." "How so?" he asked. She told him about her crisis, how she'd been disappointed with aspects of the Christianity she knew, and some of the things she'd seen, in fact, at his own church. She told him that she'd actually been considering converting to Islam. He was listening closely, but he didn't seem worried about losing a member of the congregation. Oh, that's just the devil toying with you, he said. He'll do that, try to tempt you away from Christ. But this'll only make your faith stronger. You'll see come Sunday. When he left, Kathy already felt more certain about her faith. How could his visit not be a sign from God? Just at the moment she was having doubts about her church, a messenger from Jesus walked straight into her life. She went to church that Sunday with a renewed sense of purpose. Yuko may have found comfort and direction in Islam, but Kathy was sure that she herself had been personally called by Christ. She walked in and sat near the front, determined that her new friend should see her and know that he'd made a difference. It didn't take long. When he looked down at the congregation and upon her, his eyes opened wide. He gave her an expression that made clear that she was the one he'd been looking for all day. She'd seen the same expression on kids spotting a birthday cake with their name on it. And then suddenly, in the middle of the service, her name was being called. The preacher, in front of a full room of almost 1,000 people, was saying her name, Kathy Delphine. "Come up here, Kathy," the preacher commanded. She rose from her seat and stepped toward the blinding lights of the pulpit. On stage, she didn't know where to look, how to avoid the glare. She shielded her eyes. She squinted and looked down at her shoes, at the people in the front row. She'd never stood in front of so many people. The closest thing had been her wedding, and that had been only 50 or so friends and family. What was this? Why had she been called forth? "Kathy," the preacher said, "tell them what you told me. Tell us all." Kathy froze. She didn't know if she could do this. She was a talkative person, rarely nervous, but to recount something she'd said privately to the reverend in front of 1,000 strangers, it didn't seem right. Still, Kathy had faith that he knew what he was doing. She believed she'd been chosen to remain in this church, and she wanted to serve, to help. Perhaps, like Reverend Timothy entering the store that day, this was another event that was meant to be, meant to bring her closer to Christ. She was given a microphone, and she spoke into it, telling the congregation what she'd told the reverend, that she'd been investigating Islam, and that the preacher cut her off. "She was looking to Islam," he said with a sneer. "She was considering," and here he paused, "the worship of Allah." And with that, he made a snorting, derisive sound, the sort of sound an 8-year-old boy would make on a playground. This preacher, this leader of this church and congregation, was using this tone to refer to Allah. Did he know that his God and Islam's were one and the same? That was one of the first and simplest things she'd learned from the pamphlets Yuko had given her. Allah is just the Arabic word for God. Even Christians speaking Arabic refer to God as Allah. He went on to praise Kathy and Jesus and reaffirm the primacy of his and their faith. But by then, she was hardly listening. Something had ruptured within her. When he was done, she sat down in a daze, bewildered but becoming sure about something right there and then. She smiled politely through the rest of the service, already knowing she would never come back. She thought about the episode while driving home, and that night, and all the next day. She talked to Yuko about it, and they realized that this man, preaching to 1,000 impressionable and trusting parishioners, didn't know or didn't care that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity were not so distantly related branches of the same monotheistic Abrahamic faith. And to dismiss all of Islam with a playground sound, Kathy couldn't be part of what that man was preaching. So by fits and starts, she followed Yuko into Islam. She read the Quran and was struck by its power and lyricism. The Christian preacher she'd heard had spent a good amount of time talking about who would and wouldn't go to hell, how hot it burned, and for how long. But the imams she began to meet made no such pronouncements. "Will I go to heaven?" she asked. "Only God knows this," the imam would tell her. The various doubts of the imams were comforting and drew her closer. She would ask them a question, just as she had asked questions of her pastors, and the imams would try to answer, but often they wouldn't know. "Let's look at the Quran," they would say. She liked Islam's sense of personal responsibility, its bent toward social justice. Most of all, though, she liked the sense of dignity and purity embodied by the Muslim women she knew. To Kathy, they seemed so wholesome, so honorable. They were chaste, they were disciplined. She wanted that sense of control. She wanted the peace that came with that sense of control. The actual conversion was beautifully simple. With Yuko and a handful of other women from the mosque present, she pronounced the Shahada, the Islamic pledge of conviction of faith. "I bear witness that there is no deity but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger." That was all she needed to say. With that, Kathy Delphine had become a Muslim. When she tried to explain it to friends and family, Kathy fumbled. But she knew that in Islam she'd found calm. The doubt sown into the faith gave her room to think, to question. The answers the Quran provided gave her a way forward. Even her view of her family softened through the lens of Islam. She was less aggressive. She'd always fought with her mother, but Islam taught her that heaven is at the feet of your mother, and this reined her in. She stopped talking back and learned to be more patient and forgiving. "It brought back a purity in me," she would say. Her conversion might have been a step forward in her eyes, but in the eyes of her mother and siblings, it was as if she'd renounced her family and all they stood for. Kathy tried to get along with them nevertheless, and her family tried too. There were times when all was good, visits were enjoyable, uneventful. But for every one of those, there was one that spiraled into sniping and accusations, slammed doors and quick departures. There were a few of her 8 siblings she wasn't in touch with at all. But she wanted extended family. She wanted her own kids to know their aunts and uncles and cousins, and so the relief was profound when the Odyssey arrived at her brother's house in Baton Rouge at 11:30. She unpacked the kids and they fell asleep on couches and floors in minutes. Settled, she called Zaytoun. "Wind's come?"
"Nothing yet," he said.
"I'm going to pass out," Kathy said. "Never been so tired."
"Get some rest," he said.
"Sleep in."
"You too." They said good night and turned out the lights. Sunday, August 28th. Kathy woke before dawn and turned on the TV. Katrina was now a Category 5 storm with winds over 150 miles an hour. It was heading almost directly toward New Orleans, with the brunt of it expected to strike about 16 miles west of the city. Meteorologists were predicting furious winds, 10-foot storm surges, possibilities of levee breaches, flooding everywhere along the coast. It was estimated that the storm would reach the New Orleans area that night. Throughout the day, as news of the hurricane grew more dire, clients called Kathy or Zaytoun, asking them to secure their windows and doors.